Hi, everybody. This is Dean Haglund, not from the offices of Rational Exuberance, but from the middle of the tawny, hip neighborhood called Las Feliz.
You're in France.
Oh, yes. Way to blow it. Presently, though, we are recording in advance because Phil always blows the surprise.
Pre-recording is the word you're looking for.
Yes, exactly. I'm Dean Haglund, of course, and this is Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, and I'm here with my co-host, Mr. Phil Arness.
Or, as I'm known in France, where you are right now,
Phil Nuffity Nuff. Not Ocho Cinco, when I was in Puerto Rico. That's how they knew you there.
What are you doing in France?
I'm on a tour of Provence with my watercolor sketchbook. And capturing many of the delightful things and going to Cezanne Studio, seeing where Van Gogh painted, the whole nine yards.
And you are bicycling the whole way.
It's a bicycle tour. That's right. We go to a hotel and then they pick up our luggage and drive it to another hotel. And then we have to bike over there to the next hotel.
That's fantastic.
It's totally fantastic. And it's not with a tour group. It's just us two by ourselves, my girlfriend and I, and we can go off on tangents. We can stop at any restaurant. Go drink wine at the wineries, and you just have to get to that hotel sometime in the evening.
Wow, that I can't wait to hear.
It's going to be awesome.
How that is going for you right now?
It's going fantastically.
When we last left off,
we were in mid question
from Phil Sternweis, one of our favorite listeners, frequent contributor.
Very.
And it was about remakes, and he was taking me to task about apparently at one point defending remakes and saying remakes are good. And again,
I don't remember you saying they're good. I remember you saying there's got to be something right about them.
Right. And
because the logic
behind them.
Right.
Yeah, the logic behind them. And just as a way of, you know, so that I could let go of the animosity towards them, you know. And many times on this show I've gone... I've railed against, oh my God, The Third Man's being remade, you know, True Grit is being remade, everything's fucking being remade, and you know, it's like, oh God, you know, it's like you were saying last week about with acting, you know, sometimes it's just so frustrating to, why do I even want to be a part of that industry where this is where people do it?
Yeah.
You know?
Right, and I don't have a union that supports it, and I'm paying two dues to.
And so,
two unions.
Why do I want to be in a business where everything is geared towards the remakes
so
and
heavy.
What?
Yeah,
and why do I even want to love film when everything that's going to be coming out is going to be pissing all over my memories of these movies?
So the idea is to get out of your negative.
Out of that, and to realize that there's always something right about.
There's got to be something right, just as there's got to be something right about two unions.
And if you can get to that point of understanding, while this is one of the reasons that they do this, you know, then maybe you get to say, well, how can I push off that and what can I create with this and how can I use this?
Right. Excellent.
So that was where very much my point of view was coming. It wasn't really that they're ever good. It's just that there's always something right about it from a certain point of view, from a certain perspective.
And that point of view is marketing.
And the more that you can understand that, then, you know, the easier navigating this world. This chaotic thing called living is.
I like to point out Godfather 2 won an Oscar.
That's a sequel, not a remake.
Oh.
Right. Okay. So I would like to point that out.
Oh, you hit me.
No, and
try to think of a remake.
And Phil was quick to point out that there have been remakes that are good. You know, one of my ones that, you know, I love to point out is Maltese Falcon.
That was a
classic.
Remake?
It ushered in film noir. One of the two films to usher in film noir. Put John Huston on the map, created a leading man career for Humphrey Bogart after being a supporting player.
Yeah.
It was his first lead role, and it was the third version of that film in 6 years.
Wow. I did not know that.
One of the versions starred Bette Davis and was called Satan Met a Lady, which actually is a title that makes a great deal of sense.
Totally.
Given that storyline.
And it also might be the name of my heavy metal band.
Satan Met a Lady. So, but Paul Allen, I think, will sue you for patent infringement on that. Call back. To last week's show we recorded a few minutes ago.
Yep. No, so, stop it.
Well, you know, you can find every installment of this show at chillpackhollywood.com, C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K, Hollywood.com, where you can download and stream every episode that we've ever done and subscribe via iTunes.
Very easy.
You know, you can also find us, and welcome to our listeners who check us out on Jackalope.
Jackalope Radio.
Jackalope Radio.
Where we stream twice a week.
Twice a week. And you can always hear the most current show on MySpace at myspace.com/ChillPackHollywood, where you can become a fan of the show if you want. And even if you don't want, you can listen to it there. And you can find a blog previewing the next week's show.
And become a liker on Facebook.
Well, while we're at it with all the websites, become a liker. Facebook.com/ChillPackHollywood.
Spectacular.
Now, with these remakes, though, it was... interesting because apparently at some point I mentioned, and again this outraged Phil, that I had said that there are no new stories.
Ah.
And he said, of course there are new stories. He gave an example of new stories. And I said there are no new stories. And I would like to point out historically that the point of view I was coming from was, of course, the same as Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Story that there are the seven. Is it seven or
seven?
No? Seven.
I heard
seven different stories. There are seven different stories. That's it.
And Aristotle said that too, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
The there are only those. There are no new stories.
Structurally.
So he pointed out, for an example, and it's kind of fun. It's charming that this was the example, Planet of the Apes.
What?
And he said, you know, tell me, you know, man evolving into apes. Tell me where that story appeared before, you know, and all these sort of things. And I would like to point out that he's confusing story with plot.
Right.
And this is not semantics. This is very, very important. And people do this a lot. They will, you know, what's the story of the film? And they'll tell what the plot was.
Right.
The story is the journey, the emotional and psychological journey that the character takes.
Right.
So the story of Planet of the Apes has nothing to do with apes or evolution or any of this, except insofar as it has to do with perhaps the apes and the evolution within the psyche of the main character.
It's technically a fish out of water story.
So there are only these seven stories that we keep coming back to.
Boy meets girls, fish out of water, blah, blah, blah.
What Phil did point out, though, that and I think we've talked about this, is that it is always possible through these different plots, through different structures, through creating different constructs, different forms, you can ask new questions.
Ah, right.
And we always talk about this, and that's one of the reasons we will make things, you know, to ask a new question. You know, indeed, that's how a lot of times these things come about. Our documentary Truth Is Out There came about with the question, what does it mean to search for the truth? Everybody's so busy searching for the truth, but what does that search mean?
Yeah. And how do you know when you found it?
So we were motivated by asking these new questions.
Fantastic. And like Planet of the Apes was...
And of course, the value of any question can only be measured in how much that question can be embodied.
Mm.
The question... If you're not asking a question that can be embodied, I would argue you're not asking a worthwhile question.
Right.
Right?
And that was Picasso's quote, the problem with computers is they can only answer questions.
You know, the question people ask is, you know, when will someone love me? Or how can someone love me? How can I, you know, all these sort of things. When will I be loved? You know, but that's not something that you can embody. But what you can embody is how can I be more loving?
Ah, see?
How can I be more open to the love that is all around me, or to the love from this person? How can I be more open to love? See, these are questions we can embody.
Absolutely.
And I think as filmmakers and artists and storytellers, you're looking for that same kind of principle, which is what are questions that the film or the play or, you know, that
or
can
the Broadway
embody?
Musical, like you're almost about to break into.
What question can this embody?
Yes.
And that question of what does it mean to search for the truth? Well, it's a tricky proposition, but if done correctly, the structure and form of the film will embody the very question itself. So the film is the answer to it. So I agree with him wholeheartedly that it's, and that's what it is about, is how can you ask new questions. To get back, though, to the idea of, like, even the idea of the plot of Planet of the Apes being particularly original, would say it's incredibly original. Yeah, if, I guess, you know, you're not a fan of H.G. Wells and Island of Dr. Moreau and The Time Machine Rod Serling's earlier stuff.
Right. Everything else he did is structurally...
It's structured the exact same stuff as his earlier
Twilight Zone episodes. You can actually see Twilight Zone episodes that are almost structurally, well, totally equivalent because he wrote it.
Right.
Yeah.
It's making connections between these things.
Yeah, right.
It's not about necessarily, you know, again... And this idea of remakes. You know, there is a way of looking at, as I always said, one of my favorite Westerns, Rio Bravo, as a remake of High Noon.
High Noon.
It is, the better word for it is response. It's a response to, rather than a remake.
Right, you told me this one. And
because it's the exact same story.
But
Howard Hawks was offended by the politics of High Noon because it did not represent to him the American character as he believed it to be. So instead of arguing against it, he told a story. And he told the same story, but the way that he understood the psyche of America.
Right, that it's not about being abandoned by going alone.
Instead of the hero being alone because no one will help him, the hero turns down the other help because it's his job to take this risk.
Right.
And that's how he saw it. And what's wonderful about this is that every level of it, you can see there his response to this material and to these questions.
Right.
Instead of an 88 minutes in unfolding in real time, it's 140 minutes with times out for song. Instead of black and white, it's
color.
Luscious color.
Yeah. Well, it's similar to the way Vampire Sucks is a response to Twilight. And never mind. It's in theaters now. Big hit.
It'd be so much fun to have Phil as a guest on the show because he always brings up these things that lead to interesting discussions.
Right. But that's not this week's show.
No, but what I think is so interesting about that... and by the way, remake, before we let this go...
What are they remaking?
The early reviews haven't been good. It's already out now, since this is pre-recorded. the remake of the Coen brothers' Blood Simple.
Oh.
It's really being marketed as a remake of... But when you're transplanting it to a different century in and a different country, culture. You know, that's like saying, again... Magnificent Seven is a remake of Seven Samurai. Of course, Seven Samurai was influenced by American Westerns.
Right.
And again, these transplantations.
Yes,
but now we use the idea of a remake as a marketing tool. Hello.
Yeah. So this is the girl and the shop and the key or whatever the hell that's
it's
called.
The woman, a gun.
Oh, yeah.
And a noodle shop
and
from
noodle
Zhang
shop.
Yimou.
Right.
The great Chinese director.
Who made Crouching Tiger and Hidden Dragon.
No, that's on
On the
Hero.
Hero.
And, House of Flying Daggers.
The House of Flying Daggers, that's right.
Yeah, but so many other great costume dramas also.
Yeah, I mean, so this is a period piece that's supposed to be a remake of Blood Simple.
And the trailer looks so much fun.
So much fun.
Yeah, so.
But the reviews are good.
The early ones here, anyway, I don't know. But internationally, from Cannes, I think it was well-received.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
I don't trust anyone.
So, in talking about remakes...
Yes.
It occurs to me often that James Bond enters into the mix.
Ah, yes.
Because there is a way of looking at James Bond that every James Bond film is a remake of another James Bond film.
Wow.
Really, the pattern was set so early on that they were just kind of remaking it, and you put in the different the plot,
right?
But the same elements time and time again. You're just remaking them that again. Certainly, there were a couple of early templates of different types of James Bond, and Bond was for decades thereafter a remake of one of those two templates.
Absolutely, like a detective novel. There was some sort of mastermind criminal, and he had to solve, get the point, get to the bottom, find the mastermind, and blow up the lair.
And so when you're talking about inspiration behind creative endeavors, today's show was inspired by you being in France, so we needed a pre-recorded show, by this question about remakes,
yeah.
And also by the fact that, as we addressed at the beginning, you can find every episode
of your
Chilpack Hollywood Hour at chilpackhollywood.com, except one. In 2007,
wow, was it that long ago?
July 7th, 2007,
yeah.
07, 07, 07,
oh,
we did a show all about 007.
Remember that?
And I think only 7 minutes of it are available.
Oh, my God.
And so we've always talked about maybe we could find it, maybe we could... But why don't we just
so right now, it? If I go back to 07 on our thing, that show is up, but only 7
it's
minutes.
It's up, but it yeah, it cuts out after a few minutes.
You kidding?
No. I've told you this many times before.
I know, but I looked at it and it's got it seems to have its full file in there.
That's interesting.
Yeah, so I'm shocked that it's I thought okay.
But so we thought, you know, we've done so many theme shows, so many top 10 shows, everything like that. But especially as the Bond franchise was reaching a new level of popularity.
Spectacularness.
It was spectacular with Casino Royale, a new level of popularity, really unseen since the early Sean Connery Bonds.
Yeah.
And now it's been stalled because of parent company MGM's financial difficulties.
Ouch.
You know, we just don't know. Of course, Bond will come back. James Bond will return, as they say at the end of every one of the films. We just don't know when.
I know.
And we don't know if it'll get to be Daniel Craig. He certainly wants to do it. They certainly want him. But you never know how this will shake out, how many years.
How many years it takes. Because now, correct me if I'm wrong, MGM owns the license of James Bond. Is that correct? And now that they're in bankruptcy, they only have that and, I guess, one other franchise as their leverage to buy their get their way.
Something,
to
yeah.
mortgage their way out of bankruptcy.
Yeah, I mean, their problem is they weren't able to create any other franchises. Yeah, but right. MGM, through their acquisition of United Artists, that's how
MGM,
the James
UA.
Bond franchise, yeah.
Right. And so this isn't, you don't think that this is a positioning so that the James Bond, so Mr. Broccoli, who owns it, technically can go sell it to another studio.
I think maybe eventually it is.
Right?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. Michael G. Wilson, who is the head of, what was the, now I'm forgetting the name of the production company, Eon Productions, I think, that makes the Bond films. Yeah. And who, along with his wife, is a wife or sister? I don't know. Barbara Broccoli is in charge of
the
films.
Sister, yeah.
And anyway, and he, of course, learned from Cubby Broccoli and produced films with him and wrote some of the films. And so anyway, it could very well be that. They may be just done saying we're going to keep making movies under this untenable situation.
Right.
And one way or another, we're going to get a real studio behind us.
Right.
Absolutely.
And MGM will collapse because that's their only lifeline of blood.
Because they can't make Bond films without Eon Productions, and Eon Productions can't make Bond films for another company.
Right.
So
they're kind of trapped.
It might be a little bit of a right now saying, look, we're done with this. We've been playing this for decades. MGM constantly on the brink.
And that's too bad because Daniel Craig was at the perfect age right there.
Right.
And his window of opportunity.
And he was about to become, when we last left off with Quantum of Solace, he was about to become James Bond.
Right. Yes.
He had been growing into it.
James Bond.
The character himself.
Yeah.
You know, it was the origin story, and now he was about to become the Bond that we know or think we know.
Get the license to kill and the whole thing.
So, anyway, so we thought, since we're frustrated by not getting a new James Bond, which we were supposed to get this year, frustrated by that show not being available from 2007,
right,
and inspired by this talk about remakes, let's revisit James Bond.
Yay!
By doing our top 10 favorite James Bond films of all time. And I think we're including in the official James Bond canon the first Casino Royale, which was the big comedic parody.
Yes.
With David Niven, Woody Allen.
And did I tell you when I was at the Fringe Festival in Edinburgh, there was a fantastic one person show by an actor who looked and sounded exactly like David Niven. And he came on stage with a martini glass.
Rich Little?
No, better than that. This actor's name, I'm sorry, I forget it, but you walk down the street and it's as if he looked and sounded exactly like David Niven. Same eyes, the whole nine yards, same age. And he told the story of how that first Casino Royale came together and how Peter Sellers had the heart attack and wanted just to be a serious actor, and how they brought in Woody Allen then to cover for Peter Sellers not doing the comedy that they thought that it should have. And it just, this whole story of how it spiraled out of control.
Out of control.
So amazing. It's like such a phenomenal backstory to seeing this.
Yeah, Peter Sellers wanted to really be thought of as James Bond.
Because he had a heart, he had not just one heart attack, he died 8 times on the table, which was ironic because he is known for 8 great comedic characters before that, being Dr. Strangelove and some of the other ones. And as he was going through his heart attack, he had to get the paddles 8 times to bring him back to life. And when he came back, he had this epiphany that comedy was just sort of futile, and that being a serious dramatic actor was really the direction he should go. And yet everybody still continued to laugh, not realizing, you know, it was.
It ultimately paid off, though, with being there. I mean, that really was the.
That was quite the, yeah, the final.
His final.
Well, no, Dr. Fiendish Plot of Dr. Fu Manchu is.
Was released later, but I think it was shot earlier.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
Okay. Probably.
But, anyway. So we have our top 10 James Bond. We are including in the official 23,
yeah,
the remake of Thunderball, even though it was made by a different company.
Yeah.
Never Say Never Again, but it was remade by the man who owned the actual rights to that one, the man who came up with the concept for the first film of James Bond, a TV film, That was scuttled. It never got made.
Oh,
and then Ian Fleming used that storyline in his novel, which is how the lawsuit happened and why Spectre and Blofeld never appeared again, because those were creations by this TV producer who introduced them. They got introduced in a novel. Cubby Broccoli and his partner Harry Saltzman liked those villains, so used them in all the Bond films,
right?
And then lost the rights to it.
Ugh.
And so that was Never Say Never Again, a remake of Thunderball, and it brought back Sean Connery to the role in 1983, and we are including that in our discussion, if that makes either of our lists. And also,
Never Say Never Again, making one of our...
Well, okay. and the other component to this that I'm bringing in that I've never done before...
Oh?
I went to the Internet Movie Database.
Look at you go.
And I compiled the votes of all the voters over the years that have voted... rated the Bond films, and I have compiled, according to IMDb's rating system, the top 10 James Bond films as well.
Wow.
So we'll compare how our personal taste, where it involves perhaps the most commercial franchise of all time.
Yes.
Certainly the most enduring franchise at this point film. And we will compare how our tastes match up with the public at large.
Fantastic. Are we starting number 10 up?
Let's
to number
go number 10. Yeah, if you can do 10-1, first of all, that'll be a Chilpack Hollywood Hour first.
Oh, you bastard.
Now, there would be 10 titles in 10-1, by the way.
Well, I'm just trying to dig it up here on the phone. But, you know, always.
Wait, you dig it up on the phone. I don't want to get into the problem where you start doing one and then we are left with, wait a minute, I still have my number one. No, you've done your number one.
Okay. You start then.
Yeah, why don't I start and I'll buy you a little time.
Thank you.
Because I wanted, if I could, to include all the different Bonds, the different actors who played James Bond.
Of course.
Because, of course, if we count just these movies, of course, the original James Bond was Barry Nelson, at least actor who played it, was American Barry Nelson in a 1955 CBS movie of Casino Royale, a live production with Peter Lorre as Le Chiffre.
What?
I've
never seen this.
In terms of the films, the feature films, 23 feature films, we've had 6 actors play the role of James Bond, and
right.
I wanted to include them all if I could. So that made it a little bit difficult because for number 10, you know, I'm considering a few different titles. Like the first one, Dr. No, it's a fun movie, but it really hadn't quite, to me, hit its stride.
Really?
So I didn't include
it. So that's your number 10?
No, so I didn't include it.
I'll see mine. I had Dr.
I also, well, why are you giving away?
Oh, sorry.
So I thought about Thunderball.
Oh, yeah.
I thought about Living Daylights, which I thought, you know, if you consider it for Timothy Dalton just a screen test, I go, well, that's one of the greatest screen tests of all time.
Yeah.
But instead, I felt I needed to include a Pierce Brosnan, James Bond film. And let's not forget that financially, the series hit box office success worldwide. And again, you compare box office to different eras, it's a little apples to oranges. But really, playing against the field... Bond was really back. Bond was as popular as ever, thanks to the stewardship of Pierce Brosnan in those films, those four films he did in the late 90s and early 2000s. And the one of the four that I included on my list at number 10 is 1999's The World Is Not Enough.
Oh, you did that one.
The third of Pierce Brosnan's films. The one where I felt like he had really grown into the role. He had a certain gravity. He had a certain weight to him. He was allowed to act. It gave Judi Dench her best role. Mm-hmm. She's kidnapped in that film. Sophie Marceau, a wonderful counterpart to Bond. Great actress, beautiful, mysterious. There's weaknesses, of course. Third act drags.
Yeah.
Denise Richards, you know, one of their famously bad casting of Bond girls, playing a nuclear physicist in hot pants.
And this is the one.
Or short shorts. But directed by Michael Apted.
Oh, yeah.
Very,
that's right.
Very
good
director. Great documentarian. The 7-Up series.
That's right.
And really, we got to see some good character work of Bond. So number 10, The World Is Not Enough.
Wow. Awesome. Well, for me, number 10, as you said, we want to honor all the actors. But mine is His Majesty's Secret Service.
Honor Majesty's Secret Service.
Yes, with George Lazenby, which actually was a really great actor. And he really embodied James Bond really well, I thought. And then I love the sinister woman with the shoe, the knife in the shoe. What?
No, that's not that one. The knife in the shoe, that's from Russia with Love.
Oh.
That's
Lotta
Lenya.
Lotta Lenya.
Peter Lorre's wife.
No way.
From Russia with Love, yeah.
I didn't know that was Peter Lorre's wife. You're right, I got that mixed up.
You did get that mixed up.
I'm sorry.
Telly Savalas played Blofeld in Honor, Majesty's Secret Service.
Right.
It's the film where Bond got married.
That's
Diana
right.
Rigg
finally
Diana Rigg. Found a Fine woman
the love,
that
and
was
then,
his match. His
oh,
love.
That horrible tragic ending.
Yeah.
And where he plays it very well, I thought.
Beautiful theme song from Louis Armstrong, We Have All the Time in the World.
That's right.
It's a beautiful film. It's gorgeous. The action was also, the way it was, the film was directed, Honor Majesty's Secret Service was directed by Peter Hunt, who had been editing the Bond films. And he edited these action scenes in a way that really was, you want to say cutting edge because it's a pun, but it was really forward thinking.
Yeah.
In terms, it really influenced action editing from there. I will say this about Lazenby. I don't think he was a great actor. I don't think he was even an actor at that point. He was a model.
Really?
He was a non-actor. He did embody the role of Bond well. He fit the description of Bond quite well from the books.
Right. Yeah, if you look at that.
Much more so than Connery.
There's a drawing in one of the Ian Fleming novels. You can see it on Wikipedia. And it actually looks a lot like Lazenby.
And he was surrounded by great actors. I think he could have developed into a very good James Bond if given a chance. But his own personality and the pressure he was under. And he didn't have, as an actor, he didn't have, I mean, you've never acted before, first of all. And then you're being thrust into the lead in a franchise. It's hard to remember. Think Beatlemania. And you'll get a sense of how crazy the world was for James Bond.
Yeah.
Everything was James Bond on television. How many remakes of Bond did we have?
Secret
Wild
Agent.
Wild West, Secret Agent, you know,
all of
the Man from U.N.C.L.E., I Spy.
Even The Prisoner, you would say.
So, you know, he was thrown into this pressure cooker, and he, as an individual, wilted under the pressure, acted out, and It became an untenable situation for him to continue as Bond.
Right.
So they redid the casting search, which ultimately led back to Connery for the next one. But I think he would have grown into a very interesting James Bond.
If they didn't recast him.
But so that's your number
10.
Number 10.
Yes.
Number 10 from the public at large.
Oh.
Honor Majesty's Secret Service.
Get out.
At 1969. And that's why I spent so much time talking about it just now, because it was the public's number 10. Even though it wasn't Bond, everyone kind of acknowledges that what works really works.
Yeah.
In that film.
Isn't that great?
My number 9 is the film right after that that brought us back Sean Connery, and brought back a Sean Connery who was a little bit overweight, looked a lot older since the last time we saw him, but who also brought with him such a kind of world-weary, old-prose grace to it. Not a cynicism. He wasn't walking through it. But
which
it
film
was
are you
really,
talking about?
And it's Diamonds Are Forever,
yes.
1971.
That's spectacular.
Guy Hamilton, who directed Goldfinger, came back to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Love the homosexual assassins.
That's right.
Mr. Winton, Mr. Kidd.
Isn't that right? The Scorpion's the perfect killer, Mr. Kidd.
The last one where Blofeld would appear and be named as Blofeld.
Right.
He would make a cameo appearance in a later film.
Because that was the Fort Knox.
Diamonds Are Forever.
Yeah, no. But the other cameo appearance, was that...
No.
Okay, got the backwards.
But interesting that you mentioned Fort Knox and Goldfinger, Diamonds Are Forever, directed by the same director as Goldfinger, sort of a remake.
Kind of a remake.
Of Goldfinger. It's that same kind of plot
line.
Device. And again, lasers. We're right back to using lasers as the threat.
Isn't that funny?
Much like in Goldfinger.
Do I expect you to die? Yeah, no, I expect you to die, Mr. Bond.
Do you expect me to... Yeah, that's from Goldfinger. Do you expect me to talk? No, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die. So I always wanted to play a Bond villain. Always wanted to. That's a role I would love to...
I could totally see play. It.
Anyway, yeah, Diamonds Are Forever, 1971... great Mustang driving stunts, too, on the streets of Vegas.
It's streets of Vegas, and it's old Vegas, Fremont Street. You could actually, you walk down that street now. That's the one that's covered by the light show when you go to Vegas.
And some really fun, cool, dark spy things to even get them to Vegas.
Yeah.
Like the cremation.
The cremation and the fake
smuggling of diamonds. And it goes from South Africa, Amsterdam, Los Angeles, Vegas.
Yeah. And putting down that global thing that all the Bond films had, that it was really international and the locales getting more and more exotic. So
number nine for you.
But Tomorrow Never Dies.
Is that your Pierce Brosnan one?
That's my Pierce Brosnan one.
The first half of that is my favorite half of any Brosnan.
Yeah. Second half does kind of fall apart.
It just slows down. And
yeah. And that's also the one where he's married to, I'm trying to think of the actress' name.
No, he's not married in any of them.
No, yeah, it's the one woman. I got that mixed up.
Terry
too.
Hatcher
yes.
plays Jonathan Pryce's wife, who helps Bond because they used to be lovers.
Right.
And she therefore dies a very violent death. And all of that stuff works great.
Yeah, I thought that was really
great. He's aided by, and this was their first attempt to bring in a woman spy counterpart for Bond that would work most famously in Die Another Day with Halle Berry as Jinx.
Right.
Even talking about a spin-off movie for her that didn't happen.
Ah,
but Michelle Yeoh
that's
played
right.
a counterpart as a Hong Kong secret police in Tomorrow Never Dies.
That's right. That's what I was thinking.
You know, the first film to really introduce Michelle Yeoh to American audiences.
And make her the big star.
Yeah.
She was great. So I love it. That's my number nine. Your number nine?
Well, I was going to say the public's number nine, but they have a two-way tie for eight. So why don't we start with their two-way tie for number eight?
Which is?
You Only Live Twice from 1967.
Huh.
And Thunderball.
What?
From 1965.
That, no way.
Two Sean Connery ones.
My Thunderball's way up there.
My number, well, why do you give away? Go 10 to 1.
Okay,
all right,
yeah,
my number eight. Is actually I screwed up. All right, so I'm gonna make no.
Let me taste the deliciousness of the irony. Oh,
we'll edit that out.
No, we're not. That's.
Oh my god, I made a note here. Remember to flip those. I guess Diamonds Are Forever was actually my number eight. But so my new number eight is I have become you.
Oh
my lord.
You. Good lord.
My interest in improv comedy.
Yes.
My inability to count from 10 to 1. Okay. The Spy Who Loved Me.
Ah, yes.
1977.
Roger Moore.
It's not as good as Diamonds Are Forever in 1971, but it's one spot higher on my list. Roger Moore, directed by Lewis Gilbert. It really was the film where you could say Roger Moore became James Bond,
made it his own. Yeah.
After Live and Let Die and Man with the Golden
and
Gun.
And was it too jokey in it? I mean, the later ones, when they became sort of...
Well, no, the early ones are really the ones to me that are more jokey.
I think it became jokey later.
Well, Moonraker, certainly, after Spy Who Loved Me, is totally jokey.
Oh, yeah. Moonraker is my least favorite.
Even turning Jaws, who was such a great character in Spy Who Loved Me, into a joke in Moonraker, ruining that.
Totally.
But Spy Who Loved Me, you know, you have colorful characters like Jaws. Mm-hmm. You have colorful locales. I mean, Bond in Egypt.
Hello.
When he walks out of the desert with the theme music from Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And of
awesome.
Course, back then when the pyramids were way out in the desert, Cairo
exactly.
wasn't all around
all wrapped around
pyramid.
It. That's right. And the Lotus Esprit that turned into a submarine.
Oh,
how cool
yeah.
is that? That's
the
awesome.
Great theme song. The ski sequence off Asgard with
oh,
the
yeah.
opening of
the
Union
thing?
Jack.
Totally awesome.
It really, especially for those of us who were
kids.
Probably coming of age with Roger Moore as our James Bond.
Yeah.
That was kind of the seminal James Bond film.
Yeah, totally. I remember seeing that in a theater right in downtown Winnipeg and just being blown away because it was the middle of winter, too. And anyway.
The Spy Who Loved Me, my number eight. Your number eight?
My number eight was... Didn't I just say that one? No, I didn't. Live and Let Die.
Oh, the yeah. first Roger Moore,
yeah.
James Bond film.
Where he has to, you know, with all the voodoo and the double-decker bus thing and a great Paul McCartney theme song that became a big hit.
Yeah, huge hit. I always had misgivings about McCartney's theme song, not because it's anything other than a great song. It's a lot of fun. But this is a character, James Bond, who in Goldfinger... chastises a woman for wanting to drink champagne before it's chilled properly.
Uh-huh.
And he says, my dear girl, certain things are not done, like drinking the champagne above a certain degree Fahrenheit. Yeah. Why, that would be like listening to the Beatles without earmuffs. And less than 10 years later, he's one of the Beatles is doing a James Bond theme song.
But it's McCartney and Wings, which where
but still,
he's grown up. He's
He grown up? And yet Bond is now Roger Moore, is not a grown-up. So that was...
How ironic.
But I do agree with you. It is fun. I would have it, you know, maybe one of my runner-ups. It's fun. Love Yaphet Kotto. Always
oh, yeah.
love him. He's the villain
good,
in it. Of course, Jane Seymour, so beautiful.
So gorgeous.
And they had to really work, because it's established that she's a virgin, so they had to really work to... make it okay for Bond to go to bed with a virgin.
Yeah, exactly.
Because they really knew they could lose some audiences there.
Yeah, that'd be
but
just
you know
shocking.
What struck me? Also, my friend David Hedison, with whom we've worked on Spectres,
oh, that's
his
right.
first appearance as Felix Leiter. But I love the grittiness of the New York sequences.
I know. It's almost like it's from like Shaft and all those
yeah.
70s.
Blaxploitation
movies that you're just like, wow. And they really, you know, to me, I like that urbanness and then the exotic locale and stuff. I thought it was a really well-rounded James Bond movie.
I think there's just an element of it for fans, and I'll talk about this again later, where it doesn't feel James Bond. Again, it feels that. People decide that's not James Bond. I don't want a smuggling plot. You know, I don't want that.
He's a spy.
You know, we want it more colorful, more flamboyant.
Well,
and
that's so gay. But not in the sexual.
How great Jeffrey Holder is Baron Samedi, the ghostly type figure. You never quite get a handle. Is he real? Is he a ghost?
Yeah.
In it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Love
and how
that,
great, that
mystery.
That mirror and the supernatural
ends
element
with him sitting on the front of the train laughing at the end of
That's right. I forgot about that.
Yeah, Live and Let Die is an underappreciated Bond.
I agree.
I will give you that.
Thank you.
I don't have a top 10, but I do think it's underappreciated.
Mm.
My number seven, however, is very much like Live and Let Die in the sense that many people will say, criticize it as saying, well, yeah, it's a good movie, but it's not James Bond. And that's License to Kill, the second Timothy Dalton Bond, where Bond really darked out.
Yeah, yeah,
got
yeah.
Got really dark. Bond quits. He resigns his License to
that's
Kill
right.
to go on a personal vendetta to avenge the people responsible for the attack on his best friend Felix Leiter and
yeah.
the murder of Felix Leiter's wife.
Yeah.
And what I love is, again, David Hedison, the only actor to play Felix Leiter twice until the Daniel Craig Bonds.
Right.
And when Jeffrey Wright has played it.
Into,
but Hedison returned. It alludes back to Bond's marriage. Which was nice.
Yeah.
It is a very emotional Bond to me, and some of the most extraordinary stunts and brutal fight scenes because they're personal.
Yeah.
And
they really went all out on that one, too. That was like to bring Timothy Dalton into the foray.
And yeah, because they realized after Living Daylights that their biggest strength was we have a great actor playing Bond.
Yeah.
So they let him do it, and people missed, people raised on Roger Moore missed what they thought was their James Bond.
Right.
And
the kind of debonair, you know.
And they felt that this brooding, dark Bond who's very much the book.
Yeah.
The one who needs to be in therapy.
Right,
the
right.
The one who chain smokes and drinks to excess and beds down these women because his life is toxic. That he needs, that he is such a great man of action because he has no fear of death. Rather, he has fear of living.
Isn't that true?
Which is why he embraces all these vices.
Yeah, yeah.
And Dalton got that. But for many people, it was a great two-hour feature film, Miami Vice, and not their James Bond.
How interesting.
You know, clearly I loved it, and it's my number seven.
Your number seven. Fantastic. What did the audience pick? Was that the tie?
The audience, no, picked at number seven, The Spy Who Loved Me.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, go figure.
I will say it's in the top 10 of the Internet Movie Database users' votes. It's the only Roger Moore in the top 10. It's The Spy Who Loved Me at number seven. So you're number seven.
Wait a sec. Am I counting this wrong?
Oh, dear
wait,
God.
Wait. I don't want to do what you did. So one, two, three.
Yeah, four. By all means, take the time now when it's your turn.
Right. So then my number seven
uh-huh.
would be Dr. No.
The very first.
The very first Dr. No.
So your number eight was Live and Let Die.
Live
the
and
very
let die.
First Roger Moore.
Yeah.
Your number seven.
The very first
Dr. Sean No. The very first Sean Connery
yes.
Bond.
And this is also the one that, of course, is oft parodied by Austin Powers. But that's the one I saw as a kid. I remember
many of them are oft parodied. I mean, there are many that are, but
I know, but it would seem that the production values, that lighting, the crazy mountain base with the ridiculous monorail. Wait, am I getting that mixed up?
No, you're getting that mixed up again. That's,
yeah, which one is that one?
You're thinking of You Only Live Twice in
no,
Japan, the
yeah.
mountain base. But the but this is
Dr.
the
No
one.
Had the base.
Dr. No is a big nuclear reactor
that's
out
right.
on an island.
On the island, that's right. The island nuclear reactor.
It is such a fun film.
There's
it's
no
so question
much fun.
It's a fun film. The introduction of Bond is great.
It lays down the groundwork for everything that's
Ursula
to come.
Ursula Andress coming out of the water in the bikini.
Hello.
Lays down a lot of groundwork for Bond girls,
yeah.
future Bond girls. You know, it is fun. It gives you this globetrotting adventure. It's just, again, it's not quite Bond. I feel like...
What's missing?
I feel like it's a pilot episode, right? And then they went back and they go, okay, what's missing? And we put in all these other
right.
pieces and fleshed it out.
I guess. For me, I like the simplicity of it, though.
And the, you know, the Dr. No himself is...
A lame villain.
It's a little... Although we would see him again, I felt like, in Enter the Dragon. I felt like Dr. Han is Dr. No.
Dr. Han is
you know,
Dr.
with the
no.
phony hands.
Yeah,
always
exactly.
with the phony hands.
Oh!
okay, which might also be what inspired Dr. Strangelove in a degree, I wonder, a couple
oh,
years later. You know?
Hey, that's
Dr.
good.
Dr. No, Dr. Strangelove with the fake hands.
My God! I can yeah. walk! Yeah. Hilarious.
Okay, number six for me.
Yeah.
Honor Majesty's Secret Service.
Look at that.
I do not share quite your affinity for George Lazenby.
Uh-huh.
I don't think he's as good as you think he is.
I think
the movie is better than you think it
wow.
is. I think it is truly a perfect James Bond film on every level.
What? Except for?
Except the lead character.
Really?
I have always maintained that if Sean Connery had played Bond in that film, hold all calls, don't even bother having a top 10 show, there's your all-time best
wow.
Bond film. When
wow.
getting married to Diana Rigg,
yeah.
their interplay, Sean oh. Connery and Diana Rigg playing off each other, and then they get married, their chemistry, and the death. Oh, my God. Heartbreaking.
Now, that would be good, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, as John Barry, the composer, who did, you know, most of the Bond films and, you know, the Bond theme, written by Monty Norman, but arranged and played famously by John Barry, when he was referring to his great work on Honor Majesty's Secret Service, the great score, the instrumental theme, Honor Majesty's Secret Service, is such a great theme. you know, he described how at the end Sean Connery would have created one of the most unforgettable moments in cinematic history.
Wow.
In that scene with Diana Rigg, and George Lazenby, this is John Barry's, couldn't create a hard-boiled egg.
Ouch! Ouch! He went on record on saying that?
Yeah.
Wow. That's like Gerard Depardieu slamming Beaunuchet.
And recently. Again, you can kind of understand the frustration and one of the reasons why they would be quick to get rid of Lazenby after the fact, just in the sense that so many people had done their best work. And let's face it, casting is everything. No. We talked about this a couple weeks ago with Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
Yeah.
I really admire the director Edgar Wright out of that film more than even Hot Fuzz or Shaun of the Dead, in the sense that I think he pulled off the trick of coming as close to making
the comic
a
book
good
book.
Film as you possibly can when you have the wrong guy playing the lead role. Yeah, everything else the director did was as good maybe as it could be when you consider you have the wrong guy.
Wow. That's so sad.
And I feel like with Thunder Magic Secret Service...
Well, now you made me... Now that I'm rethinking a whole movie with Bond, I'm sort of regretting...
But I have it higher because everything about it is so perfect. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, anyway, you're number six?
My number six. What did the audience pick? Did you go in there?
Internet Movie Database?
Yes.
Number six? Diamonds Are Forever.
Wow. That's crazy. That's my number six.
Wait. Really?
Yeah, after Dr. No, Diamonds Are Forever.
Number six.
Number
Diamonds
six.
Diamonds Are Forever.
Spectacular. As we said, it's got so many cool things. And of course, for me, just the sheer terror of the cremation scene. I remember seeing that and just being freaked out and going, well, this is impossible. He cannot possibly get out of there. Except that they pull him back out. But there was like, it just brought like the first time. I think it's the first time I actually was so emotionally connected to James Bond that going into the coffin, you know, I'm already claustrophobic and then having a burn, the fear of fire. Oh, my God, it's got so many things just in that scene.
How about when they go to the space laboratory set up out in the desert that Willard White owns, you know, the Howard Hughes stand-in.
Yeah.
Jimmy Dean, who just died this year, right?
Yeah, that was him.
Played Willard White, supposedly a Howard Hughes type character, recluse. You know, and I love that whole plot device that Blofeld and Spectre are able to pose as Willard White because he'd been a recluse for so long.
No one knew what he looked like.
And, of course, nature abhors a vacuum. So just become him, and everyone will do what you say.
Yeah,
and so so basically, Blofeld's hiding in plain sight by being a guy who's hiding.
Yeah,
and brilliant. So anyway, Bond goes to the plant to see what's going on now that Blofeld's running things, and he finds out about these experiments. But he has to escape, and he barges onto a studio soundstage
where they're faking the moon landing.
Where they're faking some kind of space landing.
Yeah, totally. And the astronauts chase after him in slow motion as he runs at high speed.
What a sly little commentary.
Sly commentary. And then he escapes in that moon rover.
In a moon buggy.
Moon buggy. And if you look at one of the shots, it's one of my favorite shots when the police cars and they're all riding around. The wheel has come off the moon buggy. And you actually see it bouncing through the shot after the moon buggy has left the frame.
Wow.
So take a look at that, because you see a giant moon buggy wheel, and I just imagine the stunt driver in that moon buggy must have just been freaking out to have like a wheel pop off on the experimental moon buggy in the desert filming.
My number five?
Yes.
Octopussy.
Wow!
1983. John Glenn directed it. He directed all the 1980s Bond films, and... Roger Moore now to me had an old prose grace about him.
Right.
It was the same year that Never Say Never Again came out, and everybody thought there was going to be this Bond showdown because they were supposed to be released at the same time.
Yeah.
Never Say Never Again got delayed a couple months. But Octopussy, which was the 13th James Bond film.
Interesting.
The ad campaign was 13 being James Bond's lucky number and about it being an all-time action high. And
all of them were all-time action high.
But it ended up doing twice the box office here and internationally that Never Say Never Again did. And it really, though not my favorite Roger Moore, there's a little teaser.
What?
It's my second favorite. And it really is so colorful. I love the Cold War espionage tale. I love it going back and forth behind the Iron Curtain, behind the wall in East Berlin.
Yeah.
The ticking clock to me works so well of the bomb going off at the Air Force base in Berlin that will easily be blamed as a malfunction, which will lead to disarmament and allow the Russians to just
walk right in
across. And that's tied in with a jewel smuggling plot based out of India. And so the globetrotting is fantastic. Are there one too many climaxes? Maybe.
Yeah.
But so much of it. And there are a couple of gags that are silly Roger Moore gags.
Gags. But I'm sorry, the title itself is a horrible gag.
Although it is...
it pays off.
Yeah, it is. There is a short story, Octopussy.
There is?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
There is also a short story, Property of a Lady, and those two short stories were blended for the plot of it. So in fairness, that is an Ian Fleming title.
Okay. Well, I take it back. To me, when I first heard that coming out and was Octopussy, it was just
I think The World Is Not Enough is the first Bond to not have an Ian Fleming title, but that was the coat of arms on the Bond family, which we learned in Honor, Majesty, Secret Service.
That's right.
Anyway, so Octopussy, really, really fun. And nice seeing him with a mature leading lady opposite him, too, Maude Adams.
Yeah, yeah.
Who, the only leading lady to be a leading lady in two different Bond films, because her first go-round was in Man with the Golden Gun.
Oh, that is the same movie.
I also love whenever Q gets to get out of the lab and become a part of the action.
Yeah.
And he's wonderful in Octopus. He gets a wonderful role in it.
Yeah, really expand him, which is great. My number five is Living Daylights, which...
the screen test for Timothy Dalton.
Screen test for Timothy Dalton. And I thought, now, I remember the pressure on that guy. More than Daniel Craig, I thought, had pressure when he came in. I thought Timothy Dalton really had a lot more weight bearing on him to pull it off. And I think he pulled it off really well. And I know actors under pressure, you know, you have to really work very hard.
Because at that point, no matter what you do, you're not Roger Moore.
You're not Roger Moore.
And you're not Sean Connery.
Right. So you're this third way.
You're the guy in between.
Yes. Are you George Lazenby? Or are you going to do...
I'm not George Lazenby. I did two fun. How about the balls of Timothy Dalton? I mean, as I always pointed out, not only does he step into Bond and follow that, I mean, that's a winless proposition at that point in time. When Brosnan did it, it was 6 years later.
Yeah.
Daniel Craig, he's playing a character that nobody... As Daniel Craig said, he's playing a character nobody played before. He's playing Bond before he becomes Bond.
True enough.
But Dalton steps in to replace those guys as Bond. Then what'd he do for an encore? Why don't I be Rhett Butler in the long-awaited sequel to Gone with the Wind?
I forgot he did that. What was that even called?
I forget, but it was the big miniseries,
totally,
right?
The horrible miniseries. That was ridiculous.
You got him. The dude had balls.
How the West was...
Adding to the cast of Chuck this year, right?
Oh, that's right. I'm not watching Chuck, but he's coming in on that, I heard. Right.
So you're number five.
Living Daylights.
Living Daylights. The audience is number five. GoldenEye, the very first Pierce Brosnan film. And you got to remember that for a whole generation, there'd been 6 years since the last Bond.
Right.
And there'd been 10 years since Roger Moore left.
Yeah.
So again, we talked about the power of seeing Spy Who Loved Me as kids. For a whole generation of kids, that was really their first James Bond film.
Right. GoldenEye. And that came out with an awesome video game, too.
Great marketing campaign, great ad campaign. It also was Pierce Brosnan, who we all knew for 10 years was going to be Bond eventually. It was a matter of if, not when.
Particularly if you're a Remington Steele fan.
But even, you know, you'd heard the press so much. Even if you were Albert Broccoli, who met him when his wife, when Brosnan's late wife, now Cassie Harris, was in Fear Eyes Only, and Broccoli first met, he said, this kid's going to be James Bond someday. Kept him in mind all the time.
Wow.
And that's why he was supposed to play it when Timothy Dalton did it, but NBC, upon having canceled Remington Steele, then decided, oh, wait, maybe we can parlay all this press over Brosnan being named James Bond for Living Daylights, and they then renewed Remington Steele, and then Broccoli said, wait a minute, I'm not going to have a Bond who people can see for free every week on television.
Ouch.
Sorry, Pierce. And so then he gave it to Dalt.
Ouch.
But it all worked out. Anyway, GoldenEye was there, number five. We are have to be lightning round. We got 5 minutes left. We may Holy go crap. A little long on
let's
this
go.
Show.
Let's go, yeah.
For well, a network along the line. How does Jackalope Radio do that when we go long?
I don't know. Okay. We probably can't.
My number four is For Your Eyes Only.
Uh-huh.
My top-ranked Roger Moore film, a great Cold War thriller, and significantly from since From Russia with Love in 63, the first Bond film that could actually happen.
Right.
It actually was grounded in the real world enough where all the things in it, could some of the stunts stretch credulity? Of course.
Yeah.
But it did not rely on any suspension of disbelief in terms of the real world. It could happen. It is really good. Roger Moore at his best.
Yes.
And really colorful spy thriller with great supporting characters.
Fantastic. Mine.
Number four?
Number four, Russia with Love.
From Russia with
From
Love?
From Russia with Love. Gotta love it. Because of that shoe with the knife in it.
Yeah.
I love that thing.
And on the Orient Express.
Totally. And it's old world, right? He's still looking for audio bugs under the lamp and all of that sort of thing. It's like it had this charm to it that I don't think any of the other ones really
had. And you
had.
Could believe that even with this, first of all, the idea, too, of pitting the two superpowers against each other and the metaphor of the Siamese fighting fish, that's really a resonant idea even today.
Yeah.
I mean, this whole concept of terrorism, I mean, Spectre was basically an international terrorist organization. And the idea that if you could pit the powers against each other, does everything that you want there.
Exactly.
But that the idea also that this international espionage plot could boil down to a mano-a-mano fight on a train in a closed compartment between Robert Shaw and Sean Connery, and that idea that it would boil down to that mano-a-mano fight made sense.
Yeah. Amazing.
Phenomenal. And in that world, it did.
Yeah. So great. You're number four?
Well, the audience is number four.
Oh, yeah.
Dr. No.
Ah.
They went from GoldenEye to Dr. No. And again, this shows to me the power of when you see it the first time and how, you know, love at first sight.
Love at first sight. So true.
My number three, From Russia with Love.
Ah, look at that.
Yeah, From Russia with Love. It really is. And I actually think that it's a great film.
Yeah.
It's a great movie. You could stand alone and show that movie to people who don't know anything about James Bond and who would have no interest in maybe James Bond. And it's a great movie. It's a great
movie.
Romance. It's such a romantic
movie.
So
romantic.
It's sexy and
everything.
Beautiful. You're number three?
Thunderball. Got a Thunderball.
Wow.
Really? No?
Yeah.
The jetpack, to me it's hilarious. That he takes a jetpack, goes up, comes down, and then throws it in the trunk of a car and drives off.
There is so much super cool stuff in that film.
Super
him
cool.
Him chasing and dancing with one of the assassins that's trying to kill him and turning her into the bullet.
Totally. Because he sees a reflection in her eye.
Really. He also gets shot in that movie
that's
and is limping
right.
through Carnival, bleeding, and
bleeding
they're following
horribly.
Him. I mean, there is so much cool stuff in that movie. And the problem with the movie, because I just watched it again thinking this would make my list, and I was surprised at how great the first two-thirds are.
Yes.
But the problem with it
is the
same problem with Never Say Never Again, the remake, which is once you get underwater for the whole third act, it completely slows down. The action is slow.
Yeah.
You can only follow who's who by what color wetsuits they have.
No,
why not put them
up.
In white hats and black hats? No, they're all wearing masks. If you put them in,
I mean,
you might be able to
follow
Bond, but remember, it's a whole war underwater between good guys and bad guys, Spectre and the CIA.
Yeah, and there's the
and you can only tell by the color of those wetsuits.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Sorry.
Really slows it down. All right, their number three is From Russia with Love.
Look at that. We're very close. Number two.
My number two. The maybe the granddaddy of them all, no problem with anybody calling it their number one, the peak of the series for a long time, and the one that gets remade the most often, Goldfinger. Entertainment, big budget, studio, action.
Huge.
Adventure.
Spectacular.
It's right up there with North by Northwest. It's the pinnacle.
I got it as my number two as well. And I got to think that the theme song itself, sung by
Shirley Bassey.
Shirley Bassey. So good.
Yeah. And the way that they always incorporate the James Bond theme, the chord progression into these theme songs.
Theme songs. So brilliant.
Good. And of course, the credits
on the body.
On the body. Of course, that was done to a degree in From Russia with Love, but really perfected in Goldfinger. Just, it set the template for an entire genre of filmmaking.
Yeah. So true.
So that was my number two.
My number two as well.
And it was the audience's number two. Look at IMDb, that.
We're all meshing.
Goldfinger, 1964, Guy Hamilton. Finally, my number one Bond I think it's film of all time.
Probably my number one, too.
First time I saw it, I said, this is the best Bond film since Connery left.
I think he said that.
Second time I saw it, I said, this is the best Bond film since Goldfinger. Third time, and every successive time since then, I've said, this is the best Bond film, period.
How many times have you seen it?
About eight times now.
Wow.
2006. Director Martin Campbell, who returned after doing GoldenEye.
Ah, that's right.
Brosnan's first Bond film. He was returned for Daniel Craig's first Bond film, Casino Royale.
Casino Royale! So good.
The reboot. Yeah. To go the Batman Begins reboot route in a world of Jason Bourne.
Yeah.
Is Bond still relevant in a world of Jason Bourne? Turns out Bond's still the coolest cat in the jungle.
So cool. And so he's not. I love that it's still rough on the edges, that this is a perfect time to cast Daniel Craig. Rough on the edges, but you could see that he could be honed to that suave, debonair Bond that we all knew.
The heart-achingly emotional core of that film.
Ugh.
It's romantic.
There's failures. He's trying to defibrillate himself, and he misses till someone else plugs him in.
And Daniel Craig with Judi Dench.
Oh, yeah.
Batting that ball back and forth.
That's awesome, too.
Yeah, it is fantastic. And, oh, by the way, the best action sequences in any film ever?
Yeah,
maybe.
When he, with the car in that one, where he has to stop short and flip all over. Amazing
stuff. So many great stuff. The opening chase sequence when he's chasing that guy.
Oh, yeah. And they're free running. Parkour over.
And you really see Daniel Craig doing it. And of course, you see the other actor doing it who was cast because he's a champion street free runner
or parkour, as they know in Europe.
Anyway, a fantastic film. If you haven't seen Casino Royale, see it. It is so great. Even if you don't think you like James Bond films, it's great. I've shown it to a lot of people who never liked James Bond, and they love it. And kudos before we go to the editor, because we've talked about this before. The editing on these films is so important. The director always gets elevated in filmmaking, putting all the pieces together. But you know, the editing in Bond, often you really see how important. And it's not a coincidence that so many of Bond editors then go on to direct the Bond films. John Glenn. I mentioned.
The other guy,
Terrence Hunt or Peter Hunt.
Peter Hunt.
But Stuart Baird edited Casino Royale. Stuart Baird edited Superman. Stuart Baird edited so many great films. I keep seeing Stuart Baird action movies that he edits. His reputation has fallen because of some of his directorial work,
right,
like Star Trek Nemesis.
Yeah, yeah.
Which really needed Stuart Baird editing
it. Right, he had to be in the edit room.
But you see the difference, because Quantum of Solace, directed by Mark Forster, you've said before, you know, these action, you look at the action scenes, they have all the pieces, but it doesn't work as well as in Casino Royale, and it's the editing.
It's the editing. Like I say, Salt may not have been a great movie, but those action sequence edited it so well.
So,
there you go.
Number one, and the audience's number one internet movie database of all time, by quite a sizable margin, Casino Royale.
Look at that.
We all agree. Mr. Mainstream. We are just, okay, we've given all the websites. You know where to find us.
Yes.
Become a fan of the film, of the show, rather.
Please.
On Facebook, facebook.com/... Chilpack Hollywood. This and every other show brought to you by the miracle of Chilpack, keeping your laptop running fast by keeping it cool. Check it out, chilpack.com. Until next week, I'm Phil Nernis.
I am not
Hagler.
Dean Hagler. Dean Hagler. And I'll be back for free.